Blog Talk Radio.
Hold it now.
Talk Productions, one of the few Black-owned radio network radio stations that address solutions to the Black community, presents Black Urban America. All you folks that are listening by laptops, you could dial 516-531-9540. That's 516-531-9540. And if you have a comment, you may press 1. The lineup, as usual, is on Tuesday. We have myself, Black Urban America, and I am Kenny Jones, your host. On Wednesday, we have The Cutting Edge with Rashawn and Justin. On Thursday, we have The Part of Harlem with Wayne A. Young. And on Saturdays, we have Provocative Thought with Carlton Steve. Tonight, we have a celebrity in the house, our first celebrity ever. You know, we had politicians, academia professors, community workers, clinicians, authors. But tonight, for the first time, we have somebody from the entertainment industry. And she's a playwright for Mountaintop Productions. And which is one of the Black-owned media group on the African continent that deals with TV, media, advertising, distribution. Excuse me. And her last play, Sassy Mamas, won the 2020. I don't know if I'm gonna say this right. Art Deco Award Ensemble Performance, and she has a playwright for over 40 plays, and tonight she is going to talk to us about how some of her plays deal with social injustice. And her name is Miss Celeste Walker. Miss Walker, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Yes, and I'm glad that you're able to make it. I know you have a busy schedule, and I just want to congratulate you on your award in 2020.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm honored. I'm honored to have received the award.
Okay.
And to be on the show.
Uh-huh.
And I'm honored to be on the show.
Thank you. Well, we're honored to have you. And I want you to, I want to introduce you to another one of my hosts for the Cutting Edge. Her name is Michonne Williams of Chicago. Michonne, this is Ms. Walker.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you? Nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you, too.
Okay, let's dive into it. Okay, Ms. Walker, why do your plays, I know I read a couple descriptions of your plays, why do your plays focus on the historical African-American experience?
Well, that's a good question. As you read, I've written many plays. My canon includes over 40 plays, comedies, mysteries, dramas, military stories, musicals. So I write all kinds of stories at different periods of my life, but I always like to set aside some time to write plays about historical incidents involving blacks, because black history is American history.
True that. Yeah, that's true. And matter of fact, I almost got kicked out of school for this in the 70s. I said that I wrote a paper stating that American history should be renamed African American history. This is the mid 70s, and they almost kicked me out of the department.
Really?
Yes. It's the truth. It's the truth. And my mother was very upset at me. You know, you said sometimes you just can't reveal all of your thoughts until the right time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. So I always wanted to ask an artist this question. Before we get into the questions that I would like to ask you on social injustice, I just want to ask you a couple of things about the entertainment industry that really strike as my nerve. You know, how come there are no positive images of black men in the storylines?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. And I tell
you, and nobody asks of it. It might be a great question, but no one asks of it.
Well, they have asked. I asked. That's how I started writing plays, because I didn't see any of the people that I knew, any of the upright, decent, humorous, great black men that I knew in my life, and women. I didn't see any of them in any of the, or very few of them in any of the entertainment at that time. So that's why I said, well, you know, let me attempt to bring these characters that I know exist, these people that I know exist, to life. So that's my purpose in life. But I believe it's by design that we don't see the kind of men that we know exist. I don't know. Every black man that I know that has been in my life, I have the utmost respect for, because they've earned that respect. I don't know these men that the industry puts forth. But
from what my understanding, some of these writers are black folks that are writing these images.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, I guess they're doing it for to have a job. Now, that's one reason why I never pursued TV. you know, because that's where the money is. That's why I've always stayed on stage, you know, because you have more control with your stage material.
Right.
I've never pursued TV. I do have a few film options out that haven't been taken up yet, but they may be. But I've never pursued TV because even when I was younger, I had sense enough to know that the characters I'm creating, I know they're going to try to make me change these characters. I know they're going to try to make me, you know, do some kind of jive time, you know, dialogue or situation, you know, for the characters, some kind of stereotype situation they're going to want me to put these characters into. I say, I know they're going to want to do that, and I know I'm not going to want to do that. And so I never pursued TV. This is not to say, you know, I would turn down the right, you know, assignment, but I always wanted to establish myself first and establish my own production company first and my own reputation first, where I could have some control over the images and the representation that I knew that they would want to have their hands in putting forth.
The key word that you just said is control. And I'll go bring up that term control later on in the interview. Michonne, do you have any questions?
Yes, I want to know about her monologue. Is it Nene?
Yes.
Could you tell me about that?
Yes, Nene came about. I'm a part of this organization called Honor Roll. I'm glad to be able to mention them. It's an organization of some 1,000 female playwrights over 40. And we advocate for inclusion of women over 40. And one of the programs that we were participating in this summer with the Breath Project, who I think the Breath Project comes out of San Diego, California. But anyway, they are doing it's all over the internet. They were doing a project having to do with the George Floyd incident and people who had found themselves at the mercy of our law enforcement, who had been killed. And our group, the Honor Roll group that I'm in, we decided that we wanted to bring attention to women of color who had been killed by police officers. So we had a list of women. Unfortunately, there was a long list of women who had been killed by law officers to choose from. Hello?
Yes, we hear you.
Oh, okay. To choose from. And I chose the character Tanisha Anderson. And her family called her Nene. She was out of Cleveland, Ohio, and she'd had a mental breakdown, and her family had called for help. They had called for an ambulance to come and take her to a mental health facility, but the police showed up at her door. And it went from there, it went from bad to worse. You know, they tried to put her into the police car. She was afraid of confined areas. She didn't want to go in the police car, and they didn't handle her with any care or finesse at all. They threw her on the concrete. This was in the middle of winter, and they threw her on the icy concrete right in front of her home, in front of her family, and would not let her family approach, and took her in her night clothes and, manhandled her and threw her on the concrete. She hit her head, and when she got to the hospital, she was dead. So that's the story I chose to tell.
And that story continues to happen all over the country with our sisters, and forget the shooting down of our boys and men, you know, forget that, but the outward disrespect for our black women is from Sandra Bland to the sister in Chicago where they went to the wrong apartment and had that woman stand naked, handcuffed in Chicago, and Chicago has a black mayor. Does
yeah.
it not, Keyshawn?
They do have a black mayor.
Okay, Lightfoot, right? That's her name, right?
Yes,
right.
Okay, and here you have a black woman running the city, and these cops go into a black woman's house, and she didn't stand there for 37 butt naked. She stood there for close to an hour, that I understand. And then they give her a blanket after they found out they was in the wrong apartment. I mean, just a totally outward disrespect for our whole entire community across this country. And, you know, and we're going to dab into all of that in a few minutes. Go ahead, Michelle. I'm sorry to cut you off.
Okay. How does social injustice affect society?
Wow. Well, I think it keeps society from being what it needs to be, what it was meant to be, what it should be. It really stunts us all. It's not just stunning the people who are suffering the injustice, but it's also eventually, as we see events playing out today, it also begins to consume all segments of society when injustice and discrimination and racism and hatred and all those types of toxic emotions are allowed to flourish and to be encouraged. It eventually consumes the whole society. So I
as
think
a whole,
it behooves us. Yes.
As a whole. Your industry, the stage, right? Film. How do they view? Because different lanes, like politics, have their own perspective on racism.
Mm-hmm.
Community organizations have their own perspective on racism. The black left had their own perspective on racism. Black conservatives have their own perspectives on racism. How do people on the average, and I'm talking about the black actors, the black actresses, the black folks in your industry, how do they perceive of what racism is, or do they feel that there is such a thing as racism? Because there are some black conservatives feel racism is gone.
Well, racism,
of them. Huh?
I said racism is definitely not gone. I think different ones see it in a different way. I think, you know, we need a deeper, more nuanced definition of racism. As black people, I think some of them, you know, in the industry, see it as ugly behavior, and it's all of that toward black people. But to me, it's deeper than that. We need to think about policy that structural racism that's baked in.
That's the political lane.
Right, and society, the way it's set up. That, and finance, the financial. That's,
those are the economic boys. Those are the finance boys.
Right. You see, but they just want us to focus on
skin color.
You know, that's a part of it, you know, but that just makes it convenient to discriminate against us. I saw on the television the other day, you know, one of the persons who had got caught up in the mob activity. And before he realized it, he said, you know, we didn't know who was who, you know. I mean, you know, I didn't, it could be my neighbor, or it could be, you know, a clerk from a store or a police officer. We didn't know who were the good guys and who were the bad guys. And what he meant was they were all white, you know, so I didn't know, you know, who was who. Whereas when they are coming against black folks, they know who they perceive the enemy to be, you know, just by, you know, the skin color. So I just think in the industry, I guess I got off a little bit, I don't know how really they – well, they are discriminated against. They know that. They don't get certain roles that they want, you know, that, you know, they don't get certain opportunities, definitely don't get the opportunities and the variety of opportunities that white actors get. You know, white actors can do a variety of different roles. They can afford to do a stereotypical role every now and then and just have fun up there on stage because they have such a variety of all kinds of redemptive roles. Whereas we, you know, I think we should be, you know, a little choosier about the roles that we pick because we don't get that many. But actors, some of them feel like, you know, they have to take, you know, what they can get, you know, and trying to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
But
Gotta
pay the bills. But I think we have to go beyond paying the bills. We have to be aware of our representation. You know, they have a responsibility. And I think it's beginning to come around to them now. They're beginning to wake up to that. And some of them always knew it. But the ones who always knew it, you don't get to see them acting much because they're very...
Like Harry Belafonte. Right.
You're right. Right.
And Sidney Poitier.
Yeah. There you go. They're aware of what they're putting out there. So, you know, you don't get to see them, you know, in a lot of different roles because they are conscious of what they're putting forth. So I think, however, they actors and other people in the industry feel, I think that they need to give a deeper thought to race and racism and not just look at it in, you know, one way as opportunities that whites get that we're not getting. I think we should, you know, put together our own entertainment industry. I mean, we're entertaining anyway, you know.
Well, we used to have that, but it's gone now. And I'm going to touch on, and if we have enough time, we're going to take a stab into that. You know, have our own. Being separate, mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the last part of my interview. Don't worry, we got all the bases covered between Michelle and I. We have all the bases covered. So how about poverty? I know you guys really go interact with people in poverty, but do you guys have any type of awareness of how poverty affects our community?
Well, we are deficient in so many things due to poverty, just trying to survive, you know, as opposed to thriving. You know, we're trying to maintain that level of survival, and often, you know, we slip beneath that. That's why I say racism is finances and financial also.
You think poverty is the result of primacy and racism?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's by design. Definitely.
Well, some people say it's our own condition. It's our own fault. If you listen to a segment of the black community, especially the ones that live in mansions, especially ones that do it very, very well, is that it's our fault that we are in this economic condition because we don't take advantage of the opportunity that's out there. What's your response to that?
Well, I think poverty goes way, way, way back, all the way back to slavery. And that it is a part of the system. It's baked into the system. We were deliberately kept tethered to the bottom. We were never paid what we were owed. And so we're still trying to catch up. That's why, you know, I don't know whether you're going into that or not, but that's why I say we are due reparations. I'll tell you this. When we get reparations, which is in the trillions, we won't have to deal with poverty anymore.
You think? You think? First of all, do you think that America, hold up now, you come from a historical perspective in all of your dealings. Do you think from American historical behavior towards black folks, do you really think that America gonna give the black community reparations?
Just I think they're gonna
you know how the lawyers do. The lawyers like to go into past behavior and to make their argument. So I'm just stealing from the law.
I hear you.
You know, let's look at the look. I just want people to look at the historical behavior of America, especially the ADOS people, because they really trying to charge the reparation argument home, you know, and mm-hmm. God bless mm-hmm. them, you know. But my question always when people bring up reparation, do you really, really think that America from his past behavior until 2021 is going to give the black community reparations? Seriously, look at it. Just look at it from that perspective. You know, throw out the politics, throw out the economics, throw out everything, throw out the scholarship. Just look at the behavior of America towards the black community. What do you think? You think America is going to get the black community trillions of dollars in reparations?
I hear you. I hear what you're coming from, brother. I hear.
I'm asking.
I know, and I hear totally where you're coming from. There was a time when I would not have believed it. But times change, history moves people. We're in a historical moment right now. Now we know, and America knows, that the trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars that they have had to put out during this pandemic, they know trillions of dollars can be put out. See, we're at a different place in history now. And just like you said, when you look back at the history and the behavior, do you think they would give? I don't think they would give. I think we will take. We will be in such a position, like you said, with lawyers when they make their case. And when we make our argument and our case before the world, they will be behooved. They won't want to be on the wrong side of history.
They don't care.
Because
justice,
well, no,
the law,
but
the law of the land, the law of this land, it's anti-black. I mean,
they were so bold
to have the black codes. They were supposed to have, they were so bold where, check this out, if we were citizens, if we were thought of as citizens of the United States of America, if we were thought to have equal rights, What are we doing with a civil rights bill? What are we doing with affirmative action? Why do we have a voters' rights bill? Why we got to look at these bills every 25, 50 years? Because of the issue, what you've been speaking about, racism. Because they know this country. Matter of fact, instead of the NAACP, which was started by white folks, and our black lawyers taking people to justice, we need to take, this is only my view, take America to the Geneva Convention. Because it's a human rights issue. Michonne, you have, matter of fact, look at your mom on the phone. Because I think she's been waiting a long time.
Okay, you can put her on first.
You have a question on comment, Jackie?
I've been listening, and I like what I hear. And my take on racism, when she said there's a lot of different definitions, but my thing about the actors and actresses, I think that some of the roles they take is because those are the only roles that they can get. And I think I heard her say something that had a lot to do with finances and everything. But sometimes I think we sell ourselves out in that area just to stay alive. But I think sometimes we're going to have to say no and focus on the real problems, even in that profession. And as far as you all were talking about the reparation, I think a lot of times we have some black people who are really being paid off not to go any farther than they are. Because I think as black people, we're strong enough now. As she said, I think this is our time, and we've let time go by when we should have been pushing forward. And, you know, we get to a certain point when something happens favorably to us, we stop right there and accept just what they're giving. They do owe that to us, and until we learn to do without whatever the essentials are, we're never going to get the reparation. We just going to have to stop and say, hey, we're not doing anything else for this country until you pay us for what you already owe us.
They had a shot with this guy that's about to be president on the 20th, all right, Biden, okay? Ice Cube, Dr. Claude Addison, the NAACP, a lot of black folks went to buy an ADOS representative. And you know what Biden's response was? Talk to me after the election. Okay, they went to him
Biden's
again after the election.
Well, Biden's not going to do anything.
Hold on.
He's not going to do anything unless we make him. He's in now. What he wanted. Biden got what he wanted. We're going to have to force Biden
Let me finish the narrative. What happened? Okay, they went to him again after he won. After he said, "Thank you, Black America, you saved my butt and everything," and he said all that, and a different organization went to him. He said, "I can't talk about that right now." Wow, really? I'm not lying. It's documented. He said, I cannot talk about that right now. So that's how come I keep on asking, you know, why do we subject time? I keep on talking about time. This is the right time. Why do we keep on subjecting ourselves time after time, ever after ever, going to these folks in D.C. or the state house, the capital of your state, wherever, and asking them for assistance, you know, which later on, while I was going to ask Ms. Walker, since she wrote a play about Greenwood, and which Michonne loves to bring up about Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, has integration helped the black community?
No.
Did they burn down all of our cities? And I tell Rosewood, there was a town in Texas they burnt down. It was all over the country. Okay, they burned it down. Now we got to deal with them. Now we got to live around them. Do you think integration / diversity has helped the black community?
No.
Why you say no, Ms. Walker?
Oh, no, that wasn't me.
Ms. Walker?
I think that, of course, we should be fully integrated into American society, and we should not be denied anything that any white American has, you know, like it was before integration, because our blood, sweat, and tears built this country. So I think anything, we should be a part of any and everything that goes on in this country that we want to be a part of. That's the integration part of it. I don't think that integration has helped us the way it could have. We could have used it to continue to build what we have, but we gave up our own. I think you should always have your own. Other cultures come over and they partake. They come for the American dream. They say they partake of what we have built, our ancestors built with their blood, sweat, and tears. They come and they partake as citizens, but they still have their own. They have their own communities, their own stores, their own, you know, their own universities, their own doctors. They have their own. You always want to have your own. Of course, we should be integrated, but we should also be segregated to a degree. But we gave up.
So you feel
that
Dr. King, you feel that at his birthday is about to come up next week, you know, and in speaking of his birthday, wow, brought this out. I didn't play this, ask this question either. So you feel Dr. King's strategy, looking back on it, strategy was right about being integrated with white folks?
At that time, it was needed. We need to be integrated. We were cut out of too many social amenities. We should not have been cut out, you know. It needed to be integrated. We needed to be able to partake in any public accommodation or any public service that was offered. We paid taxes. We needed to be. No, we needed to be integrated then. We didn't need to give up what we had. But see, there's a time, that's what I say. You don't want to be on the wrong side of history. There was never a time that they would have thought we'd have been integrated to the degree that we are. There was never a time that they thought that they would be integrated.
I think we're overly integrated. And there's so much, there's so, like the word diversity, the word multiculture. Don't know what those terms do? That cut us out or reduce our role. Now, many black economists, and y'all could Google this, many black economists said, far as financially and economically, the black community was doing better prior to integration than we're doing now post-integration. Now, we're saying that. So, I just want to guess that. In fact, speaking of Harry Belafonte before, Harry Belafonte had a conversation with Dr. King right before he died when he was in Chicago. He said, "You know what, Harry? I think I'm leading my people into a burning house." The burning house was the metaphor for integration.
Mm-hmm.
So all I'm saying is that, you know, there's a lot of people that feel that we need to be more diverse, more multicultural. And I always respond, say, the black community as a whole was doing better financially and economically, better than they are doing post-integration. So will you ever write a play about, like, I don't know, you know, you wrote a play about Greenwood and what have you, and which was in the segregation era. Will you ever write something or be an author about, like, how black folks should be do you believe in separation? Not segregation, separation.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about separation?
Well, I don't have a problem with it. You know, I think sometimes that's needed, especially when you're not getting what you need or you being diminished in an integrated situation. You know, when you, anytime that you're being diminished, you need to pull away and separate yourself and build yourself up.
I see that you write a lot of plays about women, about the black women experience. How come the last piece that I saw was Malcolm X by Spike Lee in New York? Or he wrote about Fences, by Denzel wrote about Fences, and the character, that was a mixture of, like, he had good morals, but, you know, he cheated and stuff like that. But the last character, the last movie I saw that had a positive image, you know, and if you look at, you talk about African-American history should be American history, we have so many. When's somebody going to write about Marcus Garvey? When's somebody going to write about Stokely Carmichael? When's somebody going to write about that brother, Hampton from Chicago, that killed him at 19 years old? That there, Bobby Seale. When are we going to hear the playwrights, the authors, the media's model? The rappers that rap about them, well, the old rappers, the OG used to, I don't know what these new rappers rap about. When we gonna hear that? When we gonna get to see that?
Oh, that's a lovely thought. I would love to see that. I think they do have one out coming out about Fred Hampton. But I would love to see one, Marvis Garvey and Stokely Carmichael. And those are the things that we have to do. That's when I say we as black Americans have to do ourselves, because the main Hollywood isn't interested in them. And if Hollywood does do them, they won't do it justice, you know, more than likely. But my very first play, it wasn't my very first play, but one of my early plays and one of my most successful play today was an all male play called Camp Logan, a military play about World War One.
Even that, you got the boy from that was the first black general Davis. Him and his son were generals. Mm-hmm. Colin Powell, that's another figure.
Great.
Who, matter of fact, was supposed to be the first black president of the United States, but his wife said, "Oh no, you're not." Yeah. He was supposed to be quiet as a cat. General Powell was supposed to be the first. It was all up in the New York Daily News because he lived in the suburbs of New York City. And like, he was really contemplating running right after Bush's son, the second Bush. He was contemplating about running, and it was a lock. It was a lock. That if Colin Powell would have ran for president, he would have ran on the Republican ticket, and a lot of blacks will move back to Caucasus. You know, a lot of blacks originally started out as Republicans, but switched to Democrats under Kennedy. But a lot of black folks like Kennedy. So anyway, Colin Powell was supposed to be the first black president of the United States of America. But something must have happened in his past. His wife said, no, you better not. Matter of fact, it was quoted in the New York Post back in the early 90s or the mid 90s. It said, if you run, it was the late 90s. If you run, I'll leave you. That's a rumor. That is rumor.
Wow.
But that's how much she was against it. That's how much she was against it. Michonne.
Wow.
Yeah. Truth. It's fact. You can research it for yourself. This is right after George Bush, the son, 8 years term. You know, they were really trying to push Colin Powell to be the first black president of the United States of America. And I think he would did better than Obama. Much better than Obama. But that's my own personal views in there. Michonne, I know you have a question.
Okay, yeah, I do. It goes back to the integration. Okay. With the racial segregation the way it is today, because there are still a lot of places that are segregated. Do you think that the majority of black people who so-called make it would one day be willing to go back to the neighborhoods that they came from to make a change? Or do you think they're more like, okay, I made it, they're on their own. They need to do what they need to do to get out of there and keep it moving?
Well, probably some of them would think the way you said that second scenario that you offered. And I don't necessarily think any would be willing to leave what they have accomplished and move back into the quote-unquote hood. And I don't think that they should have to, because the neighborhood is a state of mind. You can help your people in the neighborhood without having to move back. Unless you want to, you know, you live where you want to live. You know, you create the lifestyle that you want to and are able to create, but you should reach back and help. You know, we are not in a position not to help each other, black folks. I think we should always, and that's how it used to be, you know, back in the day, you know, that's how we survived this long. Blacks helped each other. We were all in one neighborhood and one community, and you aspired within the community. If you lived in the projects, like I did, I came from the projects, you aspired to live in the doctor's house in Sugar Hill, or you aspired to have a store, a corner drugstore, or you aspired to be a teacher. The people of your inspiration were right there in the neighborhood, you know? So you left the hood, but yet you were in the hood because everybody was in there at different levels. But now, you know, like you said, with the integration and with the achievements that some blacks have made, they have actually moved out of the physical neighborhood. But if their hearts and their minds are with their people, wherever their people are, they don't have to physically move back, but they can still help and be aware and try to pull each other along.
Okay, but don't you think it was better for, like, say, Tulsa, back when they had Black Wall Street? Because back then they had doctors who lived in the neighborhood. They had the pharmacists who lived in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Every profession, they all lived together. They took care of their homes, and they were in a better position financially, socially.
But we didn't have gangs back then, though. We didn't have gangs back then. We didn't have shootings back then. You know, like you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. A lot of the education system is messed up in our neighborhoods and everything. You know, I think a better alternative, instead of moving back, how about buying up the property and making improvements in the neighborhood?
Well, there's a lot of communities that are doing that.
Well, that's progress. That's progress.
There's a lot of them that are actually doing that.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go. Until you improve, you know what? A lot of people move out. Like I said last week, we had a teacher on the show. A lot of people move out of the neighborhood because of two reasons. Shootings and schools. SS.
Mm-hmm.
Shootings and schools.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll take a survey, I read an article, a lot of people, and that's the reason why, you know, a lot of people moved out of the neighborhoods in the late 80s and early 90s because that neighborhoods was out of control with the crack epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And the schools were failing.
But didn't the government put the crack in the neighborhood?
Right.
Yeah.
So they wanted it to fail.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. But black folks got up out of there. You know, black folks got up out of there. They said, oh, no. And when we certain black folks move out of the neighborhood, like your pharmacists, like your teachers,
mm-hmm.
like
mm-hmm.
They might come back once a week. That usually on Sunday to go to church, you know, because the church is
right.
still in the neighborhood, you know, and they see their old pals or whatever. But like your pharmacists, like your teachers, like your business people or whoever. Professional people. When you move there, guess what's gone? Resources. Not only physical resources, but emotional ties too. Like a 12-year-old won't be able to see a young black man walking down the street to the subway in a suit and a briefcase. Instead, he gonna see the image of the corner boy selling dope. You're not going to see a couple taking their kid to daycare and one guy on scrubs doing work for the hospital and the other one got away. They were got a shirt and tie and he's a principal. You know, they're not going to see that image anymore. Our neighborhood's not going
right.
to see that images anymore. I used to see, growing up, I used to see that every day. And like what the principal said last week, you know, teachers with the church with like a welfare mom. You know, and you couldn't even tell who to go. They both look good. You know, but the only way we get the neighborhoods back and keep it from gentrifying. And I'm sorry, Ms. Walker, for taking some of your time away. Buying up property and putting in different resources to prevent gang violence and prevent these 11-year-olds selling dope on the corners. But that's all they are. They're not young men. These are little boys selling dope on the corner. And now because of gentrification, and they're kicking us out of certain cities and neighborhoods and cities, now we're building up new towns. And I hope we don't make the same mistakes that we did in our old neighborhoods. For example, New York, a lot of blacks are moving to upstate, like Rochester, Albany, Niagara, Buffalo. There's a lot of blacks up there now. Binghamton. When I was coming up, there were no blacks in Binghamton. Now, no but blacks in Binghamton. And all those people, white folks, are moving back into the city and everything. I just hope that we don't make the same mistakes that we did while we was living in Harlem, Brooklyn, and stuff like that. And it's happening all over the country. You know, you either go buy up the property or you just you build up new where you are now and don't make the same mistakes. You got to really correct the behavior. I'm sorry, Ms. Walker.
They're doing the same thing in Chicago.
Huh?
They're doing the same thing in Chicago.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's all we have, Ms. Walker. I appreciate you for coming on. And it's been a beautiful conversation. And tell some of your colleagues, man, to hit me up on Facebook where I can schedule to have them come on the show. Be the gateway into your world for us.
Okay.
All right.
I will do. I had a wonderful time.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. Be sure, what's happening tomorrow?
I'm having a guy named Goldie Robinson. He owns UCarry Solutions, and he teaches concealed carry courses, defensive training, everything. So he will be on tomorrow because I just finished the concealed carry. Right. Yes, and I finished the concealed carry course this weekend.
After the show, you should try to ask him, do you want to sponsor us, man? We need some sponsor up in here. Okay?
But I'll talk to
him. Huh?
I'll talk to
him. Yes, there you go. Okay, folks, that's it for the week. I think that was a great interview, man. You know, a playwright on the show, man. I hope she follow up and say, you know, tell some of her people about the show and everything, get some contacts in the entertainment world, you know. We got contacts in the political world. We got contacts in the education world, you know. But, you know, it's good to expand your portfolio. All right, Sean, I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay.
Everyone have a good week. Everybody be safe out there. Do not join in no demonstration. I forgot to talk about the demonstrations, too. Don't join in no demonstrations. And everything. Let's not get caught up in their mess. That's my suggestion. We spent a lot of time, this black folks spent a lot of time this past week talking about white folks' mess. That's their mess. They created that. That's what they want. So let them deal with it, as I always. I am, as, you know, like always. Y'all be safe this week, okay? I am because we are. We are because I am. See ya.
Hold it now.